being leading our briefing today. I will take Jacobs as a senior parliamentary freedom advisor. You are all welcome. Our chairperson is delayed, but he's on his way. So in the interest of time, we'll start our meeting, our conversation, and obviously we'll take over as he joins us. Today's briefing, members, on our list.
As you introduce the agenda, I just need to, for my own, for me personally, I need to leave. I see the agenda says we close at 12. I need to leave at 12, I'm afraid, so I can't stay beyond the agenda time, just to let you know.
There is a budget forum meeting that approves the budget of Parliament at 11:30, so I have to go there, unfortunately.
I think my intervention is then appropriate, so I should not waste time and get into the issues as soon as you can. This is obviously a sequel of the recent briefing that took place and the deliberation that took place around this matter. As you are all aware, members, this matter has been referred to us by Parliament, and we were supposed to have, obviously, reported back to the Constitutional Court on the progress of the matter on the 9th, which was yesterday. And I think that Dr. Jenkins will also take us through, how we have how the situation been remedied and how this whole process is taken forward. But all in all, members, we are here to continue deliberating and taking advice from the senior parliamentary legal advisor on matters related to financial management of Parliament Amendment B, as instructed by the House. Now, without any waste of time, allow me then on behalf of the chairperson to welcome Associate Jenkins, just to give us an important briefing on the matter cited. Associate Jenkins, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members, colleagues. My instructions last time from the committee was to look at the proposed inclusions or proposed amendments suggested by the Auditor General and by National Treasury. We also received comments from the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Some of the modifications to what National Treasury say, but fundamentally they can't really be given effect to in this piece of legislation. In any case, they have more to do with the Division of Revenue Book. Chairperson, as time is of the essence, I suggest that, with your indulgence, I just take the members through the proposed amendments you did to the bill, the draft bill, to show what has changed in the draft bill. And following that, one can go to the response document to show the members which comments from the Auditor General we could not include or we did not want to include, and the reasons for those. Those are a few minor ones, but it's nevertheless recommended by the committee. So, Chair, if that's in order, let me proceed. In the long title of the bill, Chair, as members see on the screen, the Auditor General wanted to include reference to performance management. Now, our response to that is that's not appropriate to put such a thing in a long title or in the objects of the clause, objects clause of the bill, simply because these are statements of intent on how to interpret the legislation, and the performance management is a tool. What we have done, and I'll show as we go through the bill, I'll show you how we have included references to performance management in the relevant sections. And the effect is 100% the same, it's just a matter of drafting. So that highlighted piece that we prefer not to include. Chair, the first amendment, and I'm going to jump between National Treasury and Auditor General. Now, in any case, who suggested what? Simply because it's more of a audit approach to go through the different clauses of the book. The suggestion by National Treasury is to amend the definition of approved budget. The reason for that, and I'm sure the members are aware, National Treasury has responded last week. We received a letter from the Minister of Finance indicating that he has no objections against the amendments proposed to the Financial Management, to the Public Finance Management Act. And And he then went further to suggest certain amendments to our financial management of Parliament draft bill. Those amendments pertain mostly to a new budget scheme, if I may call it that, that they want to introduce, where they will, as MP from Skoor said 3 or 4 weeks ago, they want to do a transfer of funds to Parliament and provincial legislatures in the appropriation bill, without specifying different divisions within that vote. So just a pure transfer vote. And the legislature and parliament will then, through their own resolutions, through their own house processes, decide how to allocate that budget into various programs. And to do that, they need to change the definition of approved budget and change various other parts of how the budget process will unfold within parliament. And they made suggestions to that. And the second thing National Treasury wants to is to make it very clear that direct charges against the National Revenue Fund does not belong to Parliament's budget. Direct charges is money that flows straight from the National Revenue Fund to the recipient, and the main part of that, as indicated in the letter from National Treasury, is member salaries. Not staff salaries, member salaries. So, in other words, that's not for Parliament to decide whether to pay or not to pay that. That flows straight from the National Revenue Fund. Overpayment of those, as happens sometimes, if a member does not complete the full month's work, there's an overpayment. Parliament requests that repayment, the return of that money will go back to the National Revenue Fund. The Treasury made suggestions to make that very clear in this draft bill. That is, in any case, the situation up to now. So therefore, they suggest this approved definition of approved budget, and all it will read now is to say, the approved budget means the total amount of funds contemplated in Section 18, and we'll get to Section 18. So that the bold piece in square brackets they want to remove. Chair, the next part. Amendment to Section 3 of the Act. Section 3 of the Act is that part, not of the Act, my apologies, of the draft bill. Section 3 is that part of the draft bill where we say, when we read Speaker and Chairperson of National House of Speaker of the National Assembly and Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, it must be construed as Speaker of a provincial legislature. When we read Parliament, it must be construed as a provincial legislature. Auditor General pointed out that where we read Section 30 in the Public Finance Management Act, it must be construed as a reference to Section 31. That pertains to the National Adjustments Budget. And then further, where we read National Adjustments Budget, it should be construed as a Provincial Adjustments Budget. And I think that was a correct submission to make. Those are now included in MNN. Chairperson, there was the matter of the conflict of interest in terms of the participation of the executive authority in the oversight mechanism, and we were asked just to suggest a way to deal with that. Chairperson, we suggest that the provision then reads that representation of the oversight mechanism must be in accordance with the joint rules, and we included the following, which must provide that no member may attend a deliberation on a matter in which that member has a material interest. So what it will, the effect of that provision will be that should there be a matter which, let's say for argument's sake, the Speaker or the Chairperson gave a financial instruction on, and the oversight mechanism must consider that financial instruction whether to approve it or not, the Chairperson and the Speaker cannot be part of that meeting. The joint rules can of course elaborate further on what exactly will constitute the material interest. But also important to take note, Chairperson, that whereas that Schedule 2 to the Financial Management of Parliament Act pertains to the Code of Ethics of the Executive Authority, this provision will go further. This provision actually deals with conflict of interest of any member that's sitting there at the oversight mechanism. I cannot think of an example where such a thing would happen, but I'm sure there will be, but it will be all dealt with. Chairperson, here we get to the certain of the suggestions of National Treasury, the amendment of Section 16. What National Treasury wants to do with Section 16 is the new scheme. The highlighted bit there is what they intend to remove. So they want to say, want to provide that Parliament's budget must cover that. Those, there's no amendments to those. But what they have covered is that just to change funds to money, so it must be money appropriate through the annual national budget, and conditional and unconditional donor funds. What they're taking away there to make it very clear is that funds that are a direct charge against the national revenue fund. So that, in other words, does not form part of Parliament's budget per definition. That money will be, one could say, ring-fenced away from Parliament's discretion to use, and any kind of overpayment or unspent funds pertaining to those direct charges will be returned to the National Revenue Fund. This is just an issue of clarity. It's always been the position in any event. But National Treasury feels it was not, in my opinion, they feel it was not sufficiently clear in the Act, so they want to use the draft or process to deal with that.
Chairperson, can I just, on point of information, that blue, is that getting into the bill?
That is getting into the bill.
Yes.
Yes. That will be the...
Yeah. Which ones are going in?
The bolded ones in square brackets are the ones we're removing. This whole Section 16. We're replacing the whole Section 16 with this, but when one looks at 16, what we're doing is just a way of drafting it, just to say this whole Section 16 should read as follows. But this Section 16, the amended parts is those which are removed in bold, and then the inclusions. The inclusions, well, we can't see it properly, the underlying part, but that is an inclusion. Conditional and unconditional donor funds. That part has always been there. Funds derived from Parliament's own revenue sources.
What is the money? Just read how key it will be. Will it be funds that are the direct charge?
No, Parliament's budget will cover the following financial year. That's a clear, specify Parliament's expected revenue, distinguishing between money to be appropriated through the annual national budget. Conditional and unconditional donor funds, and funds derived from Parliament's own revenue sources. what they want to say is Parliament must, according to main division, so this is now a new procedure for Parliament's budgets. We won't get in the appropriation bill that becomes an act later, the different divisions of the votes. There will be a transfer of money to Parliament, and then Parliament must, according to main divisions, appropriate through the annual national budgets. So those funds contemplated section 16(2)(b)(1) of the Act, those are the appropriated money that gets removed. So Parliament must appropriate through the annual national budget, the different divisions within that, or make use of those appropriated transfer that we get. What Treasury has done, they've also taken parts of section, I think it's 21 and 20, and put it in there just to create this clear provision how Parliament must deal with the transfer of funds, and through the House resolution must create a budget process for itself. The effect of this, Chairperson, is to give more financial autonomy for Parliament to deal with its budget allocations, and therefore strengthen the separation of powers issue, and places more responsibility on the Treasury functions of the Executive Authority as well, Chair. Chair, if I can read the whole provision if the members prefer, to make clear what will stay there, but what section 18 says, for each financial year, Parliament must appropriate through the annual money received through the annual national budget, that's the transfer, for the financial year, as contemplated in 16(2)(b)(1), those are the appropriated funds, subject to an amount specifically and exclusively appropriated, so that can still happen in the national budget, it's a ring fencing. And then the previous financial year, but not spent in that year, that's Parliament's own funds. So Parliament needs to approve and appropriate that. And then it must approve separately the unconditional donations and its own revenue. Those are the donor funds, 16(2)(b) and 3. Conditional and unconditional donor funds. And the unspent funds approved for the previous financial year, but not spent in that year. So that is the process, in very technical terms, to say Parliament must, through a resolution process, have his budget and get it approved. It may also then ring fence money, that's section 1A, in addition to what the national budget can provide. And then any revision, there's quite an important part, but it does not change anything the way Parliament has been offered. Any revision of an appropriation, and that middle section comes off, contemplated in section 2(b)(1), must be made by national adjustments budget referred to in section 30 of the Public Finance Management Act and in accordance with the procedure set out in section 17(2). Any revision of an appropriation in terms of one must be approved by Parliament. Now, Chair, the meaning of that, if Parliament has made an unauthorized expenditure, unauthorized expenditure is where we overspend our budget or where we spend money not in accordance with the purpose of that budget, that unauthorized expenditure. And it can happen. One can overspend your budget because of fluctuations in the value of the rand. International trips are suddenly more expensive. One can also suddenly not have a need to spend money on a certain project and move that to a different project. But that constitutes unauthorized expenditure. That unauthorized expenditure can later be approved by Parliament. The National Treasury will then, through the National Adjustment Budget, give us more money. Now, what this section does is to say you can do that on your appropriated funds, not on your own funds. So if you overspent or if you spend for a different purpose your own funds, those funds that you didn't spend previously, then you cannot go to National Treasury and ask for an adjustment budget to make your books balance. What you have to do, you have to use your own funds again to sort that accounting problem out. That's all that makes clear, and that's not really a change to how we have been doing before. And that three, any revision of an appropriation in terms of subsection 1 must be approved by Parliament. That subsection 1 of this provision is just either your unconditional donations or your appropriated funds. In any case, it must be approved by Parliament. Chair, the amendments to section 20 and 21, in my view, I would call them consequential amendments, simply to say that section 20 of the Act, if one goes to the Act, pertains to treatment of unspent funds. First unauthorized expenditure in section 20. And all it does, it makes it quite clear that Parliament cannot fill the gap, as I explained to the committee now, with an adjustments appropriation, if the reason for the non-balancing of the books is unauthorized expenditure of your own funds or your donor funds. That remains Parliament's responsibility, and you cannot go to the Treasury to approve or to give us more money to fill that gap. Section 21 is consequential to that, unauthorized expenditure of donor funds, and it makes it clear to say any unauthorized expenditure of funds derived from Parliament's own resources becomes a charge against Parliament's own funds. And not the National Treasury's responsibility. Section 23 amendment, Chairperson, is again consequential. Those parts, these are removed. That has become part of Section 18 now. It's just been moved to 18. And all it does is it speaks to the retention of unspent funds and the return of unspent funds for direct charges. And it says Parliament is not required to return to the National Revenue Fund any money appropriated in terms of or contemplated in Section 2B1 for a particular year, but not spent in that year. Chairperson, there's some drafting issues with this clause. It does not read well, and we've also got concerns with the heading. But in any case, our instruction was to just include what Treasury has said. The gist of what Treasury say here, Chairperson, is not a problem for Parliament, as far as I'm concerned, but the drafting might need to just work a little bit on that. Chair, that is basically, in a nutshell, what Treasury has proposed. The amendments from here on is what the Auditor General has proposed. Maybe the last thing I can just, again, I've fear of repeating myself, this provision is a new inclusion. Parliament must surrender to the National Treasury for depositing into the National Revenue Fund funds that are a direct charge against the National Revenue Fund, but not spent in that year. So that's just, for clarity's sake, and consequential to the other amendments. Chair, that's what Treasury proposed. We had a meeting yesterday with the Secretariat, the Secretary to Parliament, and as this amendment proposed by National Treasury does not in fact change the way the Parliament has been dealing with its funds in a substantial manner, it does change the budget process of Parliament, but my understanding is that we are not opposed to these amendments. We actually think that they will strengthen the financial position of Parliament. So we are quite in agreement with these. Chairperson, the next few amendments in red are those from the Auditor General. They propose to amend Section 34 of the Act, which deals with allocations to political parties. Now, funds allocated to political parties requires an auditing. And should the audit report highlight certain irregularities, the Secretary of Parliament must then withhold funds that pertain to that irregularity, not all the funds, but just to that one. The Auditor General submitted that this, we're speaking of a qualified audit, and they needed to change that to also look at issues where there's a disclaimer of an audit or an adverse opinion. So first of all, they suggest that we don't say in instances of a qualified audit report, but in a qualified audit opinion, and then an insertion of this for the purpose of this section. A qualified opinion means an adverse opinion, or can also be given, and again, we've just included it expressed the way they wanted it, but I think there's an issue of drafts in here. That should be come out, and it means an adverse opinion, and also be given a disclaimer, not an opinion. A disclaimer means you cannot give an opinion. That means that we cannot ascertain from the available documents whether there is proper accounting or not. So it's not an adverse, it's an adverse opinion or a disclaimer. We just need to tighten up that draft in chairperson. But that is what the Auditor General proposes. Again, we don't think there's anything problematic with that amendment. I think it will actually clarify the provision. Chairperson, the rest of the issues pertains to the Auditor General's opinion that we should make clear reference to performance management. So, in Section 48, they require, Section 48 deals with our Audit Committee, Chairperson. Section 48 of the Act deals with the functions of the Audit Committee. What the Auditor General suggests here is to include something to the extent that the Audit Committee must also comment on the quality of the annual financial statements and then include that part, the performance reporting and compliance with applicable laws and regulations. Section 56 deals with the annual the financial statements. The issue there is we wanted to capitalize standards of recognized accounting practice. We've done that. Of course, this is not a serious issue for us at all. As I say, in the Public Finance Management Act, it's not capitalized, but we can capitalize it because it's a proper noun. They also suggested that we remove this part, Jefferson, in the absence of an applicable standard, with the standards prescribed by the executive authority, but still with the purpose of maintaining consistency with other organs of state. Chairperson, we are opposed to such a deletion of that, simply because it will affect the independence and autonomy of Parliament. If there's no standards prescribed, then surely the executive authority, with the treasury functions that they have, should be able to do that. Yet, with the proviso that it must be for consistency with other organs of state, in any event, that provision will prevail. If there are standards of generally recognized accounting practice, that it will prevail. So we don't think it's advantageous for Parliament to remove that part that I'm highlighting there, which gives the executive authority the power to prescribe standards in the absence of any other. Chairperson, Section 58, again dealing with the reporting requirements of the audited financial statements. This is the inclusion that the Auditor General is proposing, the one in red. If the Auditor General is unable to complete an audit within 2 months of receiving the financial statements or the annual performance report. So in addition to the annual financial statements, the Auditor General wants to make it clear that we will have to submit the annual performance report to the Auditor General. The Auditor General will then comment on the audit and comment on it. And in terms of Section 59, which deals with the submission of the annual report, if I may refresh the committee, once the Auditor General has finalized his audit report, he gets 2 months to do that, he submits it back to the accounting officer. The accounting officer takes that annual report that includes the audited financial statements, includes the audit report, and with this, in any case, the annual report must be based on the performance report of Parliament, but now also the annual performance report. That will be given to the executive authority. This is what Section 59 does. The accounting officer must submit the annual report of Parliament, including the audited financial statements, the audit report on those statements, and the annual performance report. So it makes it explicit that the annual report must contain the annual performance report within it. And the executive authority will then table it in the House, and the Auditor General suggests we make it clear that the annual report must include the annual performance report. Chairperson, those are the amendments proposed by the Auditor General. We made a submission to the committee that it's, if not explicit, in any case implicit, and in any case practice, that Parliament deals with our performance information within the framework of your annual audits. What the Auditor General suggests is to make it more explicit and clear, not because Parliament has been resisting it, according to the submission, but because they want to set an example of clarity for other organs of state that your performance information is subject to your annual audit. So there's no principal objection against those. Chairperson, I've in the beginning indicated there's certain provisions or certain areas of the Auditor General that we did not include. I've mentioned two, that is the inclusion of performance information or reference to performance information in the long title or in the objects of the Act. Because as you can see, Chair, that we've included the submissions of the Auditor General, the relevant places where they thought it should be included. Your reporting and the Audit Committee's responsibility in the reporting to the Auditor General, the Auditor General's report back and the tabling in the House makes it clear that your performance information must be there. Let's just find the areas where we disagree with the Auditor General. So the first one, I think I've mentioned this one, is inclusion of the performance management. That's their suggestion, to include a reference to performance management in the preamble. So I've spoken to that one, Chair. My apologies, it seems that there's a screen that is not wide enough. Chairperson, the Auditor General also suggested that we refer to the document called the National Treasury Norms and Standards, the National Treasury Framework for Performance Management. Now that's a document from National Treasury, it doesn't have legislative effect or power. And Parliament is, as far as I'm advised, is in discussions with National Treasury to create a similar document or standards for Parliament's reporting, as well as for the whole legislative sector. Important point for separation of powers is that Parliament and the legislatures must develop their own documents and not be subject to the document of National Treasury, notwithstanding that there should be consistency, because the performance information should be audited consistently through government. But for the sake of performance, for the sake of separation of powers issues, and for the constitutional position of the legislatures and Parliament, we suggest that we do not include a clear reference to National Treasury norms and standards. The Parliament develop their own and create their own predetermined objectives. In any event, as we are all aware, that the Auditor General is an independent body, and should Parliament fail to create a document or fail to create a proper document to give a framework for performance information, the result will just be a bad audit coming from the Auditor General's office. So there is that checks and balances built into the system in any case in terms of the Constitution. So we did not include that proposal, Chair. Chair, they suggested these are drafting issues. To include a committee of Parliament, must also refer to a committee of the legislature, but there's no reference to committees in the rule, so we didn't include that. I'm just trying to see what Auditor General wanted to do here. They wanted to include a consultative the fiscal policy. I think that's what they wanted to include. The fiscal policy of national government. They suggested that we should also deal with the fiscal policy of provincial governments. And where we read national government, it should also read provincial government. Chair, I made a submission or advised last time that the fiscal position or the fiscal ability, fiscal powers of provinces are very limited. I mean, the Limpopo judgment is did not touch upon it, but in effect implies that the power within provincial legislatures to deal with own financial management is not there in terms of the Constitution. I went and I investigated a little bit further to the issue of the fiscal powers of provinces are subjected to I'm just trying to find the reference to that. My apologies. If one looks first of all at section 67 of the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, a province cannot give guarantees, cannot issue bonds on the international market without the authority of national treasury. And in so far as section 228 of the Constitution provides that a province can levy certain taxes. Those taxes are in any case subject to national legislation, notably the Provincial Tax Regulation Process Act, which again requires authority from the Minister of Finance to deal with it. So my view is that the fiscal powers of a province is not as wide as one would think, that they have a fiscal policy to be adopted. I think there's one fiscal policy called the Unitary State, so we did not include this suggestion of the Auditor General. And that pertains in any event to the objects of the Act. The objects of the Act is not to ensure that there's a fiscal position for provincial legislatures, but we disagree that there should be a change in that provision in the Act. So I think this is the last one we did include, we did not include. This issue of operating leases. And Chair, the reason why we're not including it is because the Auditor General suggests that there's a prohibition of going into borrowing money. You cannot borrow money, Parliament cannot borrow money without the authority of National Treasury. And our financial manager, the Parliament, without, there's no way of getting out of it. Our Financial Management of Parliament Act says clearly you cannot borrow money or issue guarantees. However, in practice, there is things like credit cards, which you need to use sometimes. And so we've always interpreted that prohibition against issuing guarantees, that it does not prevent us from paying a deposit, does not prevent us from going into types of operating leases. National Treasury suggests we make that clear because that will be the effect of the amended National Treasury regulations. And so our submission on that is that while the new Treasury regulations are not in force, and we don't know when they will be in force or what they will look like at that time, we don't think it will be appropriate to amend the Act accordingly. In any event, one must see when it comes to that point what you can and cannot do, but certainly the amended Treasury regulations won't apply to Parliament. And the way we interpret section 28.3b, which says that you may not or you may enter into certain kind of agreements, have not caused us any problems, so we don't think there's any amendment necessary to this provision. So my memory serves me well, that the last proposal we thought was not necessary, those are all included. I've spoken to this issue of the general recognized accounting practice standards and the executive authority's power, should that not be there. That's a drafting issue, Chair. I don't think I'm going to take the commitment to remove an or. That's what they suggested there. It's a drafting issue. We don't think the sentence will be thrown. This again, Chair, is where they wanted to make it change, I think, the preamble, amending the long title of the Act to include performance references there, and we think that's not the appropriate place. Chair, that is the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. I don't know, are you going to maybe at a later stage give an indication on the court process? Or do you want to do that now?
Yeah. I can give that now. We received, I think it was on the 6th on Friday, from our counsel, received a court order, but it's dated 2 September. The court agreed with the application from the Speaker and the Chairperson. From that background for the committee, the application was twofold. One was we needed to report on the progress of remedying the defect, which is put some regulatory framework in place for the financial management of provinces. Because the court on, I think it was 22 March 2012, found that there are 5 provincial acts which were invalid. Financial Management of Provincial Legislatures Act pertaining to Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Eastern Cape. Now, the invalidity of those acts was suspended for a period of 18 months to allow Parliament and the legislature to come up with a solution to remedy the defect, and Parliament and the other parties had to report by 9 September, it was yesterday. Having seen that this legislation won't be finalised
for 21 September, which is the 18-month deadline. Parliament, the Speaker and the Chairperson apply to the Constitutional Court to have the order of invalidity, the order to suspend that invalidity so that those provincial acts can continue to apply, to have that extended to 1 April, and the court agreed to that. So they received the report from the presiding officers. They looked at the application, they agreed to it to extend those acts. So in effect, the 5 provincial acts that were declared unconstitutional and invalid, they will remain operational and valid until 1 April. In terms of the order itself, Parliament and the other parties are now obliged or required to report on the implementation of legislation by Monday, 10 March. Now the court used interesting language before. They said we must report on the progress in remedying the defects. The court has now asked us to report on the implementation of legislation by 10 March 2014. So it appears to my reading in any sense that they would envisage there's some act in place by then. So that is the court process. So in terms of reporting and interacting with the court until 10 March next year, we have done what the law obliges us to do, and even what the Constitution in terms of operative government obliges us to do. So we are on track with that concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Jenkins. Members, the briefing from Advocate Jenkins on behalf of Parliament, legal team, what's your take? I note Honorable Yenge, Honorable
Thank you, Chairperson. Advocate has spoken at length about unspent monies, especially in the own revenue or own revenue of Parliament. I was waiting patiently for the reference to the unused or unclaimed monies, the suspense account. Do we have that advocate, even a treasurer, because there are certain laws that govern even the use of that. But it is not popular, this term is not popular in the financial service, where a lot of money actually resides, and that money doesn't belong to anyone, or it is not being used, because at a certain time, I don't know whether it is regarded as a saving now. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I think the vast majority of the proposals from our legal advisor we would support. They codify some of the concerns from the presenters, and I think they're generally improvable. I note the solution to the committee's concerns about the conflict of interest between the executive authority and the oversight mechanism, and I frankly don't think that it will solve the problem. If I can remind the members, we're talking here about Section 4 of the original Act, which establishes the oversight mechanism. Now, the oversight mechanism is meant to be a committee of MPs with all the powers of an ordinary committee, with all of the representativity of an ordinary committee that has oversight of the Parliament's budget according to law. And we discussed at length last time about how not appropriate for the executive authority to be on the body that has oversight over them. It's an inherent conflict of interest. And I don't think that asking them to recuse themselves on individual matters is good enough, because frankly the oversight of Parliament and the executive authority is inherently a conflict of interest if the executive authority sits on the oversight mechanism. So I can see what the legal advisors tried to do, but I don't think it will work. I think the drafting in the original text that restricts focusing on the oversight mechanism is there's no problem with it at all. It's a totally appropriate and well-drafted clause, and we should just simply leave it there. We must not touch it. That's my first point. The second, Chair, is that although this Act has been in place since 2009, requiring Parliament to establish this oversight mechanism of MPs to do oversight over our own budget, it's never been established. So we really need a clause in here that forces the establishment of the oversight mechanism. Because for the past 4 years, we haven't been law, it just simply hasn't been done. So we need a triggering clause that forces the hand here. I think otherwise the members will, we will continue to have no oversight, effectively, over Parliament's budget. Then, Chair, I have made the argument for those two further amendments. And then I have five other amendments that I've drafted here, the seven amendments, including the two I've just covered, plus the logic of why I think that we should be considering them. I wonder if, Chair, I can distribute this memo to the members, because I think it will allow members to look at what I'm proposing and what the justification for these proposals is. I've covered the first two because they're the most important, but there are five other proposals that I think we could include that would enhance the influence of MPs over Parliament's oversight. So, Chair, with your permission, I will simply distribute that memo via the committee secretary.
Nothing wrong on the distribution of the memo. That can be done now, but it's important for you to talk to those so as we're also able to get the take of the legal advice on it.
Might take a while, but I'll try and be quick. So, Chair, just to recap, my first proposal is that we simply leave Section 4, the whole of Section 4.2, as it is in the Act. It's a well-drafted piece of law and it needs to stay there. The second proposal is that we add a clause to, or a section to 5A, that forces Parliament to establish the oversight mechanism by saying that Parliament may not pass its own budget until the oversight mechanism has been established. So we can't just continue as we have for the past 4 years without an oversight mechanism. That MPs need to have that structure created before Parliament can pass its own budget. My third proposal is in Section 6, which says that the accounting officer is accountable to the executive authority. I think there should be a dual accountability. It should be to the executive authority and the oversight mechanism. Again, MPs need to have that line of accountability to the accounting officer. My fourth is in Section 43 of the Principal Act, where the accounting officer is meant to notify the AG and the executive authority if there's a problem around the tender. I think that the oversight mechanism, again, should be included there. The theme of all of these amendments is to try and give the oversight mechanism of MPs actual oversight of Parliament's budget. So you'll pick that up as I go, Chair. Fifthly, the second Section 63, the accounting officer is meant to report irregular, unauthorized, fruitless, or wasteful expenditure to the executive authority. I'm suggesting that should also be reported to the oversight mechanism of MPs. Sixth, in Section 64, this is an important one, Chair. It currently says that the accounting officer must comply with any requests by Parliament, the executive authority, or the Auditor General for information, documents, explanations, and motivations. I'm suggesting that in there we add to that list members of Parliament. It shouldn't simply be a request from Parliament as a whole, but individual members of Parliament should also have access to that information. And then lastly, Chair, I think under Section 67 2B, we need to add another subsection C, which will require the executive authority to inform the oversight mechanism of any investigation of financial misconduct by an official. 7 proposals here, which I have detailed and argued for in the memo for the members. I must just state that I think the vast majority of proposals put forward to us today we will simply support without further debate. I do have a problem with the oversight mechanism not being forced to be established. I have a major problem with the executive authority sitting on the oversight mechanism, and I think the simplest solution is to leave the clause as it was originally. And then throughout the other 5 proposals that I've made, Chair, I'm suggesting that the oversight mechanism of MPs gets real influence here. And I think that's something that should matter a lot to this committee, because it means MPs having actual oversight over Parliament's financial management for the first time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, mine was also a question of clarification with regard to improved oversight, and I think Thomas just gave us a very detailed explanation how that should be done. Just a broader take in terms of the legislation, am I correct to assume that Parliament must set an example to other organs of state in terms of improved responsibility of the Audit Committee and the performance management of Parliament, and I think that leans very strongly to improved oversight. Then a question with regards to unspent direct charges. If the advocate can just give me perhaps just a little bit of feedback again on direct charges. If these monies are not used, it would be returned to Treasury then, and it should be moved away from Parliament, direct charges category. Just a little bit of information on that. And then opposed to this, in terms of money appropriated, unspent, which is not returned, in terms of Section 18, that is then used in the following year. Is that correct? Is it strong enough? How is that condoned? Is it unauthorized expenditure, or is it just unspent money? And perhaps just linking that to unauthorized spending as well. And then, in general, my question is then, is all the recommendations then strong enough in terms of accountability of Parliament to members of Parliament?
Let me welcome the submission. I think the provision, the section 20, the provisions around the unauthorized expenditure. I'm a bit worried on the fact that we've spoken about that the court has allowed the provinces to operate with the status quo until next year April. So I want to find out the issue of responsibility and the bearing thereof and the implication around the unauthorized expenditure. When you look into the clause 20, where it goes on and speaks about where it says the provision says that if Parliament does not approve, must be recovered from the person responsible for the unauthorized expenditure. So now it speaks of individual. My worry is the issue of accountability and therefore the issue of taking responsibility. Because on the response, it only states that the executive may have authority. When you look at page 5, and I take it on that bullet point on the response, probably wanted to say department, because it says executive authority may approve departures or condone a failure to comply with the regulations and provided in the Act if undermined. So I'm just worried about that, if you can probably bring a bit of ease around that. On the, I think Treasury's submission, something that is not in the bill, that is page 15, where you speak about the issue of operating the lease agreement and so forth. I think the response is saying that we must leave it as is, must not include it because it's not proposed in the regulation. But, the suggestion that this may require certain conditions similar to those in the proposed amendment of National Treasury's regulation. I want to find out, as you say, that we need to leave it as is in the meantime because it's not in the regulation. The question therefore becomes, what happens in the main? Would we do it in the future if it's under amendment? Does it hurt anything at this stage? So I don't really find the rationale where you're sitting to say, let's just leave it as is. We feel that it's not probably important for us to edit now. I don't see the problem really. Chairperson, I'm sure on the submissions that Honourable Leaders has made, to await to get the legal advice, and therefore we need to interact with them. Thanks.
Honourable
one question. Can I ask Advocate Jenkins, in terms of the conflict of interest clause, why did you put in that which must provide that no member may attend a deliberation? Just give me an example when a member of this House can have a material interest.
You wanted to come in order to that?
I think it's Chair, just to start one two things. I do not understand in fact why Jenkins and others do not agree on the amendment made on in the object of the Act regarding reference to performance by the Auditor General. The reason being that we are omitting in the object of the Act, whereas when we go along with the Act, there is inclusive of the performance. You find that in some clauses there is the reference to the performance management. Now, if this is what we are saying, then it means there is no consistency. There is no consistency of the use of the word performance management because it was excluded in the object. Now, I am saying the exclusion thereof in the preamble and included in the other clauses, it then constitutes the inconsistency within the Act itself. And if you look at I think it's clause number 60, where you talk about the annual budget. Clause number 2. You're saying the specified Parliament expected revenues distinguished between, then you mentioned this thing, where you are proposing that we must remove direct charges. Now, my question is, when you talk about the Parliament's own revenue sources, what is that? Where do they source this revenue? How? Because for me to understand the above amendment, it will assist me if I've got a fundamental understanding of where does the Parliament source their own revenue. Now, having said that, the inclusion of the conditional and unconditional donor funds in the very same clause, right? Conditional and unconditional funds in the very same. But you are saying below, you are going to remove a clause G, which says contain a sharing of planned expenditure under Parliament's donor funding process. You are removing that. Now, that removes the accountability on itself. And I think that's why the Auditor General then proposed that they should be referenced to the performance management, because there is going to be that conditional and unconditional donor fund, which needs to be monitored. So there's a bit of unclarity. Now, if you go down to clause 17, where you're talking about the executive authority must table in Parliament, in reference to what you said about the National Treasury's norms and standards, where you are saying, as Parliament, you are going to establish the norms and standards which are not going to be the one that are being used by the National Treasury's framework. Right? The National Treasury has got those norms and standards framework. Now, and as Parliament, we are going to use them. Now, my question is based on possibility. The SEC plan, the performance plan and draft budget, all of this are to be submitted to the National Treasury. So when they get submitted to the National Treasury, are you expecting the National Treasury to use your norms and standards, or you are expecting the National Treasury to use their framework come to clause number 18. Paragraph B, approve the use of, then you omit conditional donations. Was that deliberate or typing error? You put only unconditional donations. I think it's a typing error, I'm assuming. Now, you see the word of the use of the word money in the provision. For me, it actually allows this act to get away with murder. Because you will find that if you look at clause 23, it says the parliament is not required to return to the National Revenue Fund any money appropriated. Because it says any money, then it allows that the parliament is not required to return. I don't know. I've got a problem with it though.
All right, thank you. I think, members, we have covered all the questions that you can clarify seeking ones. Advocate Jenkins, could you please shed some more light on your take on the question?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll deal with them as they came in. Thank you very much for the questions. The issue of a suspense account, Honorable Winger, I'm not sure if Parliament has one, not really in the accounts section. I can just assume we have one. I think most government departments have one, and as you say, they're not in favour because money sometimes lay there or lies there without being used. But I understand the practice is to deal with those suspense accounts on a monthly basis. But certainly from my work within the Committee on Public Accounts, a suspense account that hasn't been closed by the end of the financial year is a big problem for the Auditor General. I can't give you a direct answer on how the Parliament to deal with that. It should be in our annual report, though. It should be. To clarify where the unspent monies are, what the plan is to use them for, and why they're unspent. So that should be there. My apologies, I can't give you more information than that. Honourable Harris, issue of conflict of interest, Chair, with your indulgence. Whether Section 4 must remain or whether it may change, I think that's an issue for deliberation of the committee. May I just add that the reason why we want to allow the executive authority, and I've said this before to the committee, is because the oversight mechanism will also deal with the draft strategic plan, the five-year plan. It will deal with the draft budget for the year. It will deal with the draft performance plan, the annual performance plan, and the budget will be based on that annual performance plan. So there will be more than just an oversight function. Those will be deliberations to say to the House, we've looked at our draft budget, we are happy with it. Now, it's for that purpose that it would be specifically appropriate to have the executive authority sitting in that committee and deal with that budgeting process. Specifically also because they will be accountable for how that budget is implemented. When it comes to oversight over how the implementation was done, then clearly they cannot sit there. And that's what our amendment proposed to do. But Chair, I just wanted to remind the committee why we think the executive authority should be allowed to be on there when they shouldn't be on there. The other issue that Honourable Harris has raised to establish a trigger mechanism for the oversight mechanism, I think that the committee can deliberate on as well. One must just think it through very carefully, not to hamper Parliament's operations if the budget is not approved. But it's something that the committee must deliberate whether we want something in there. Certainly we can draft something to say that the committee or the oversight mechanism must be established, as the errors have indicated, before the budget is passed. One can also use other trigger mechanisms within 2 months of this Act coming into operation, within 3 months, depending when the Act comes into operation. There are various trigger mechanisms. Schedule 4 to the Financial Management of Parliament Act is entitled Transitional Provisions. And these transitional provisions actually does certain things. It says your strategic plan must be done within a certain time. The performance contract between the executive authority and the accounting officer must be signed within a specific time frame after the Act comes into operation, etc. So there are examples of such trigger mechanisms that one can look at, should the committee wish that we go that way. Again, with your indulgence, I don't want to say too much about the proposals made by Honourable Harris. I just want to, in general, deal with them until we've seen the memo, Chair. The Act establishes a scheme, an oversight scheme, where you have the Houses of Parliament, which maintains oversight over the executive authority. And the executive authority maintains oversight over the accounting officer. And the accounting officer is responsible for the implementation of the Act and the implementation of the budget. The Houses operate through the oversight mechanism, much like any committee is being done, much like the National Assembly uses the Public Accounts Committee. Documents are referred to the oversight mechanism for the purpose of reporting back to the Houses. So a lot of the issues that have been mentioned, one will find in the annual report, and you have that moment to deal with it. Issues of tenders not recommended, performance of the supply chain management system. These are reports that should be, will be in the annual report, and one can then deal with that. The reporting of irregularities, again, those will be in the annual report, so the oversight mechanism will have their oversight on that. So while I said let's deal with those submissions when I've seen them and contemplate them a little bit, fundamentally it's an issue for the committee to consider. Now, all I want to do is to say to the committee, let's just remind ourselves of the scheme of the Act, and let's remind ourselves what is practical in terms of what does a member of parliament sitting in a committee wants to do with the oversight of parliament. Do we want to be advised on a month-to-month basis whether there's compliance with certain things, or is the oversight, much like any other government department, when you look at that annual report, when you look at it and comments on that. Chair Honourable Ross speaks of the before I move on, specifically on the issue of investigations. Those are reported in the annual report. Government departments also need to answer to the Houses through SCOPA about what decisions and what investigation has been done to deal with certain irregularities. So again, I can just say, do we want to do that on a month-to-month, week-to-week basis as members of Parliament, or do we want to do it in the fashion of your annual reports, and that is the report that we then investigate and interrogate. Honourable Ross, yes, I would agree, and that I think is the tenet of a democracy, of a constitution. Parliament certainly needs to set an example for government department. Parliament is Parliament. It's a separate arm of government. Like the courts, it's a separate arm of government, and then you get the executive. The department is a part of the executive. So if the department wants to see how to do good financial management and how to account for that, certainly they must be able to look at Parliament to set an example. That's my opinion, in any case. The issue of direct charges, I've tried to just put this on the overhead, the submission from National Treasury. Oh, I didn't do a good job with it. This is what the minister has said. In terms of direct charges, direct charges against the National Revenue Fund. These are compensation for members of legislatures, mostly. Are not funds appropriated for Parliament or a provincial legislature. And unspent funds must be repaid to the relevant revenue fund after the end of the financial year in question. So those are, if I may, not, if they're not part of the budget of Parliament, I will ask them, certainly they can't be unauthorized. They're separate, and we want to make that clear. I say we, but through the National Treasury submission. The issue of unauthorized expenditure, it's a rather nasty word for something that happens quite often, I must admit. And not often in a deliberate way, but it just happens because of fluctuations in prices. Remember, we do a strategic plan that looks 5 years ahead, and we've got some strategic priorities to meet. On an annual basis, we look at what we want to perform, and we budget for that. But even that, in terms of the Act, it must be a 3-year budget. So you plan, and you try to envisage what inflation will do to your planning, and you try to budget on that. But in the end of the day, the budget doesn't always work out exactly like you plan. And therefore, there can be unspent money because you've over-budgeted or you've under-budgeted. Therefore, there's unauthorized expenditure. And through the year, one tries to balance those out. So that is how it happens. It's not a crime, certainly, but it certainly happens. And one must deal with it on an accounting basis to either go through a environment to move money around so that are balanced. But where there is unauthorized expenditure, certainly the reasons must be unfact and Parliament must authorize again. Now, there's further questions on that, and I'll deal with them while I am here, Chair, on that point. The issue of unauthorized expenditure must go through Parliament or a provincial legislature. That's what the PFMA says. Unauthorized expenditure for a government department or a provincial government department must be approved before one can put it into an adjustments budget to, if I can use a common expression, plug the gap. There's nothing untoward about that either. But it needs to be done like that, and there needs to be an explanation. That's why we have our public accounts committees, and you have oversight through your provincial legislature or national legislature parliament to deal with it, to ask why was it unauthorized? Why did you budget wrongly? Or specifically, one will look at trends. If there's a trend of always under budgeting and then or over budgeting, then those trends need to be addressed. The issue of, again, let's see, Andre Chabalara asked also about unauthorized expenditure. I think I've said enough about the accountability for that. I mean, there's no escaping accountability. It must be, in terms of the books, it's set separate. Indicates how much is unauthorized. So you budget it. There's also issues of irregular expenditure. Irregular expenditure deals with non-compliance, specifically with your supply chain management issues. Supply chain management says you must get 3 quotes to procure a certain thing. You must get 3 quotes. You must put a tender out. You need at least a competitive tender. But because of some kind of emergency or because of the specific nature of the product, did not comply. A lot of the time, as your supply chain management policies, this is the positive side of it, as the supply chain management policies develop, we enlarge them to include all those areas which would have been irregular. For instance, we have a policy that says you have to have a competitive process. But we realize that to have a certain product, there's only one or only two companies in South Africa who can deliver that product. So you're going to be irregular. You're not going to comply because you don't get 3 quotes, only two. But when we review our policy, we're going to specify that certain products can have less than 3 quotes. You also have something called the sole service provider, where there's only one that can provide that service. So you cannot go out on a competitive tender. Now, your policy might not provide for that, so therefore that expenditure 1 year would be irregular. But as soon as you review your policy, you're going to say, well, in certain products you don't have to have a competitive process. Now, this scope I can, what the Constitution says we will move down from when it comes to irregular expenditure. It gives us principles in section 217. It speaks of your system, your supply chain management system must be fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost effective. The way this provision has been analysed in the literature that we've studied as well as the court case is twofold. One, to say these are just principles that must apply to your supply chain management system. table, we look at that. Secondly, these are competitive principles. If one thinks of fair and equitable, transparent, competitive and cost effective, you almost always have to have a very competitive system. It's not always going to be very cost effective, so one must try and find a balance between them. To have a transparent system might not always comply with being equitable, because equitable, certainly you want to give all your participants all the information that you want. But it's at one level or another, you must decide, well, let's just take a rather nasty example of someone who has worked for an institution, a government institution before, that has inside knowledge. Now that person once resigned and a year later wants to tender for a product that they have got intimate knowledge on. So what's to do now with your supply chain management system? You need to balance that to say, well, either we need to give this information to everybody that's out there, if it's possible, depending on what information it is. I mean, one can think of confidential information or not, but we don't have to go there. On an equitable basis, one can also just say to that specific bidder that you cannot tender because, yes, you think you have a right, but you know too much intimately because you've worked here. So it's not going to be fair to put you on an equal footing with others. So there's certain balances, certain trade-offs that must be made between those principles. Now, what the provision that Honorable Chabalala has referred to is in, I think it's section 65 of the Principal Act. Section 65 allows the executive authority to condone non-compliance with certain of the regulations, including something like supply chain management regulations. Apologies, apologies for that. Section 65.4 says the executive authority may approve departures from regulations or condone a failure to comply with a regulation, provided that the objectives of the act are not undermined. Now those objectives, in short, the sound financial management of following. So if those objectives are there, what that provision will allow the executive authority to do is just to ensure there's been, because of a shortage of time, because of a gap in your supply chain management policy, you could not get three quotes to get a marquee for a certain event. But we got the marquee nevertheless. We got value for money. There's been no corruption. There's been no mismanagement. It's just a non-compliance issue. Those can be condoned because the objects of the act have not been frustrated. Of course, that cannot happen time and time again, but that's what that is aimed at. It's not to cover up any kind of accounts, but it is merely to make that seemingly irregular expenditure regular for accounting purposes. But be that as it may, none of this can be excluded from your annual report and your financial statements, or from the audit committee or the auditor general. So that's just to indicate what it is that we envisage, but that has been there all along. As I said, it actually comes from the Public Finance Management Act, and the same applies to provincial legislatures, that they can also do certain condemnation, and they must certain approve their unauthorized expenditure. Chair, if I may move on to Honourable Kurnos' question, can I give an example?
No. Chairperson, can I just say I missed your clause. I thought you were putting in that sentence and the others involved will remain.
No,
I will be totally against. I will support Honourable 100%. There is no way whatsoever that executive authority can serve on that committee. Parliament has taken back Parliament. What's happening in this institution for too long, it's run by officials, and they know there's no oversight, and so do the speakers. So it's time for this parliament to take it back, like all other parliaments in the world. So I will be very much against that. The original, that is the way it should be.
Oh, well, were you done responding to issues of
the
No, that's your take, but proceed outside of all the issues raised by members, because that's the committee we still need to do. We will check our time to do that.
Yes, I was going to say, thank you, Chair, for that. Now, the issue
make it clear to everyone, that part gets removed. That part gets removed. That's the proposal that was made in the draft bill. So we align members of the executive authority to sit on that committee. Chair, we've done some research on this. There are certain parliaments that do not allow the executive authority or their speaker to sit on the oversight committee. But there are many who have a type of commission that deals with all their oversight, where their executive authority sits on that body that performs oversight. Again, I would just want to say, because of the enlarged functions of the... for schools and hospitals. So that's an area there, but we keep those funds. Other own funds that we receive is from the interest. Money lying in an account in the bank earns interest. That becomes part of its own funds. As well as through investments. We invest money through the Reserve Bank, and the funds we get from that remains a foreign, it's foreign's own funds. There needs to be an investment policy to effect for that. So that those are all own funds. What Treasury's submission is all about is to say that those direct charges do not become your own funds. In fact, they're not even your own budget. Ma'am, your last question, I think, was on the norms and standards for budgeting. There are two sets of norms and standards here. I think I don't have to repeat the issue about the norms and standards for performance management. As I said, Parliament is busy with developing their own document on that. It's an issue for separation of powers. But the norms and standards for your budgeting and your financial management for your financial statements, like any other organ of state, you follow the general recognized accounting standards. That's been given to us by the Accounting Standards Board that's established in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. And the minister appoints that board, the Minister of Finance. So there we get our norms and standards from. All that we're doing with this act is to say, should there be no such norms and standards, then the executive authority perform that function, that treasury function of setting the norms and standards, on conditions that it's set, to ensure consistency with other organs of state. And that has been in the Act, that's not a change we want to make. For some reason, the Auditor General wants to remove the power from the executive authority, that authority to set the norms and standards, but it must lie somewhere. The Parliament is in charge of its own finances, and there are no norms and standards. Somebody must have the duty to set norms and standards how to do financial statements, how to do budget. But it's balanced. It's balanced power. It's balanced because we need consistency, something the Constitution requires, that a coherent financial management system. So I don't think that's going to expose us to inconsistencies or expose parliaments to deal with not being able to fit into a consolidated financial statement framework. That's what the PFMA requires. When we submit our documents, there must be a consolidated annual financial statement for the whole republic. For that purpose, we have the accounting standards. And that's why we need that consistency. So that check and balance as well. It's not, I don't think there's a danger that Parliament will come with a hand-scribbled notes about our financial management that cannot be incorporated. In fact, it will be a non-compliance issue. It cannot happen.
Thank you very much, Advocate and Honourable Members. We have received the briefing from our legal office. And from here, members, we will then have time to collaborate on that. I'm relying on that this is scheduled to take place early next day. It's not going to happen. Because we need to get obviously an appropriately polished version, and then from there we're going to see that it's accommodated by the final reform which is in the time. And you think of Section 76 to the other house. So thank you very much, members, and we will meet tomorrow at 9 to listen to National Treasury responses to submissions made to the deliberations of the tax laws amendment bill and the tax law administration bill. That will be tomorrow 9 and the day, of course, we will send Is it not 9?